Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture sponsored by the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Speaking will be Israeli journalist and historian Tom Segev. Mr. Segev's lecture is titled 1967, Israel's Longest Year. We begin with an introduction by Wiesel Center Director Professor Stephen Katz.
Good evening. It now is my pleasure to open this evening, which is a kind of looking back and a looking forward, really, on the impact and the meaning of the Six-Day War in Israel in 1967. Those of us who were old enough to really be fully conscious of what was happening in 67 remember it as one of the turning points of our lives, really, a kind of critical moment, an existential crisis of enormous proportions, which many liken to the fear of another catastrophe after the Shoah. And then, of course, after the first 24 hours passed and we started to get news about the extraordinary military situation where the Israeli Air Force had succeeded in destroying the air forces of the neighboring Arab countries, even people who weren't religious had a sense that this somehow was a miracle. We really were this close to a miracle as perhaps we were ever going to get to be. And when many of us hoped that this would be the war to end all wars in the Middle East. Unfortunately, it was not. And it only contributed its own sort of content to the bitter struggle in the Middle East. And the last 40 years have been, in some way, a continuing response, a continuing wrestling with the issues raised by the aftermath of the Six-Day War. That victory is not always so clearly victory, and various things arise that are unintended. The iatrogenic consequences are always more important than anything you can imagine, the unintended consequences. It's a great pleasure tonight to have a very distinguished Israeli commentator with us. Dr. Segev returns, really, to Boston University. He received his Ph.D. here in the 1970s. He came to work in German history, and he did a dissertation in the history department on the commandants of Nazi camps, which was published as his first book. He then returned to Israel, and as many in this audience will know, probably know him best as a very, very important commentator on the Israeli scene for Haaretz, the leading newspaper in Israel. He has also been a student of the sort of larger issues that work themselves out in Israeli society on a daily basis, but are large meta-themes. He wrote an important book on the 7th Million, which was the study, a study of the consciousness of the Holocaust and the survivor consciousness in the life of the State of Israel. As you all know, the State of Israel has the largest number of survivors, and that whole issue of Holocaust memory, of Holocaust remembrance, is a deep theme in Israeli life, even when it's not articulated. And in that book, he was able to draw out many of the deeper themes. He is now on the eve of publishing a major book on the 1967 war that will be published by Metropolitan Books, which is a branch of Henry Holt that probably is a branch of someone that is a branch of someone, because today all of the publishing houses, I think, are owned by one publisher in Berlin. The fact is that we look forward to the book. It's called 1967, Israel, the War, and the Year That Transformed the Middle East. And tonight, we're delighted to have him with us to talk about 1967, Israel's longest year. Professor Dr. Segev.
Those of you who follow the news from Israel, as I'm sure many of you do, will know and will have noticed over the last few days how deep the doubts still are in Israel concerning very basic issues of identity. Almost 60 years after the establishment of Israel, we still don't know what it is we want to be. Who it is we want to be, and it's quite striking, I think, if you look at today's press. Now, a lot of it is somewhat similar to what happened 40 years ago. on the eve of the Six-Day War. And I'm sure that those of you who do follow events and public discourse in Israel nowadays will not be surprised when I say that the year 1967 is not over. Most of the years when I worked on my book were years of terror and oppression, both extremely cruel. Again and again, my work was interrupted by the wail of ambulance sirens rushing to the scene of terrorism, followed by dreadful news. Sitting by my computer at the window that overlooks the old city and the Dead Sea, I followed the progress of an ugly cement security wall as it crawled along the hilltops, dividing Jerusalem for the first time since 1967. And so it was not easy to work against this backdrop, and I often had the sense that I was writing about the year that sparked all this misery. To be sure, 1967 started long before 1967, by which I mean that the elements of the conflict between the Arabs and Israel go back almost 100 years. We shall be celebrating the 19th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration this year, several months after we celebrate the anniversary of the 40th anniversary of the Six-Day War. And still, I think that the Six-Day War created a temporary situation that is still lasting. And almost everything that happened in the region since that war occurred in its shadow, which puts 1967 somewhere in between history and memory. I see that among you people, some of you are old enough to remember the events of 1967, and you are the people who frighten me a little bit, because you're the ones who remember. When I talk to Israelis about 1967, there's always somebody in the crowd, who in the audience, who says, why do you bother going to the archives? Why do you even bother? Why do you go there in the first? I can tell you all everything about the Six-Day War. I know, I remember. I was there on my tank in the desert. Of course, a soldier on a tank in the desert never knows anything at all about the general picture of a war. But I will not be able to convince him that anything was any different from what he remembers. Because where memory and documents collide, documents have no chance. Memory will always prevail, especially in the case of 1967, which left such a strong imprint on people's memory, and which, by the way, still today is not easy to document. For example, we don't really know whether or not Israel already had an atomic bomb in 1967. And it makes a big difference if a government decides on a war knowing, if the ministers know somewhere in the back of their minds that somewhere in the basement there is an atomic bomb, or if not. So we don't even know, we don't really know at what stage the Dimona project was in 1967. If Israel had atomic capacity in 1967, we don't know if any of the ministers knew about it. And so I think this is a major, this makes the whole story different, and we simply don't know. Much of Israel's foreign policy was conducted not by the Foreign Office, but by the Mossad, which is Israel's equivalent to the CIA. The Mossad does not open its archives to research. So that part is very, very difficult to research. The territories conquered in 1967 were administrated largely by the Shabak, which is Israel's other secret service, and the Shabak doesn't open its archives to research. So it's very difficult to understand a lot of the dynamics of the occupation and of the administration of the territories without having those documents. Fortunately, Israeli officials have a very commendable habit, which really should be encouraged. They take home secret documents and never bring them back. And so Israeli historians are often measured by their ability to locate the relevant widows. And I was actually very lucky. And as you will see when you get to reading the book, much of the more significant information actually comes from papers which perhaps we should politely call tonight private papers. But these are all government papers which you can find in everywhere. The events that led to the Six-Day War, as well as its course and consequences, have been widely researched and analyzed. Michael Oren has done so, and others. But I think that to understand why the war broke out in the first place, it is not enough to know the diplomatic and military background. What is needed is a deep knowledge of the Israelis themselves. The three wars of June were an international Cold War story. They were an Arab-Israeli story. They were a Palestinian story. But more than anything else, we are having here an Israeli story. In the mid-1960s, Israel was emerging as one of the more impressive, one of the more dramatic success stories of the 20th century. Most Israelis had good reason to be proud of their country and believe in its future. The state had existed. It prevailed two wars. It had taken in millions of new immigrants. Nation building was working. The culture was flourishing. In fact, cultural celebrities from all over the world came to Israel to admire Israel. Everybody from Alfred Hitchcock to Jean-Paul Sartre came to admire Israel. You know this annual contest of high school students in mathematics, which is an international thing, still happens today, where high school kids from various countries compete on mathematics. In 1966, Israeli high school kids reached the first place all over the world. U.S. students reached the last place. There was talk of an Israeli space program. If you walk the streets of Tel Aviv, you would find that one of every 10 cars is a car assembled in Israel. This all happened 19 years after the establishment of Israel. So people really had good reason to believe that this is not only a success story, but perhaps the most important thing for people anywhere to believe is that their children will have a better life in Israel, better than their own, which, of course, is quite easy because we are talking about Holocaust survivors, we are talking about people from Arab countries. But this was a very optimistic mood. People believed in the future. Beginning in 1966, all this is gone. All of a sudden, more and more Israelis started to lose faith in themselves and sink into depression. Doubt was everywhere, and it led to despair. I copied some of the headlines for you from the Daily Press. During the year and a half leading up to the year, the year and a half leading up to the war, the following headlines appeared in the newspapers. How did they manage to destroy this country? The seeds of destruction, the crisis, the shattering of a dream, death of a vision, vision and failure. Israel is not a challenge, and many, many other similar articles with similar headlines. The papers reported demoralization, bitterness, distress, indifference, and desperation. And the papers were right. One of the things which I did for this book was to go to former Israelis who have been living for a long time, especially in this country, but in other countries too. And I said to them, go up the attic, go down to the basement, look for letters which you received from friends and relatives in Israel. And I was able to locate about 500 such letters. And they reflect a feeling that the Israeli story is over. Very, very deep sadness, deep disappointment. Now, there were several factors contributing to this mood. It was an unexpected economic recession and growing unemployment. Until then, Israel enjoyed almost uninterrupted, booming economic growth. Marvelous in international standards, like 16, 18% economic growth annually. There was a sudden decline of immigration to Israel, and an increasing number of Israelis were leaving the country for good. Until then, about 2 million immigrants had settled in Israel. In 1966-67, more Israelis are leaving Israel for good than Jews who are coming to Israel. There was only one such year before, in 1952 or 53, I think. And then the people who left were actually new immigrants. People came to Israel, saw that it's not for them, and left. So this is not the same thing as leaving Israel in 19 years after its establishment. And that had a very strong effect. Again, it comes out very beautifully in the letters. We heard about this one who is selling their apartment. We heard about this one who was seen entering the consulate of Australia. And we heard about this, and we heard about this. And they are getting letters from Chicago, and these are going. So this is an atmosphere of leaving a sinking ship. Now, this is so harmful for Israel, because nothing can be more offensive to the Zionist ego than Yerida, as the emigration was called, in contrast to Aliyah. At one point, that led to black humor. And you all have heard the joke which people in 1967 told each other. And it was printed in the newspapers. According to that joke, there is a sign hanging at the exit gate of Tel Aviv Airport saying, "Would the last person leaving the country please turn off the light?" There's nothing funny about it. You really should ask yourself what kind of a society invents such a joke, this kind of black humor. Something is going on in this society. Israel at that time was beginning to lose its European Ashkenazic character, which worried no small number of people. As you know, the Zionist dream saw the Jewish state as a stronghold of European culture in the Middle East. By 1967, for the first time, Ashkenazic Israelis were losing their majority. We also witnessed at that time a very deep gap between parents and children, which was a new and quite frightening experience for many Israelis. It is quite astounding to see, when you follow the public discourse in Israel, how much time and how much energy was invested in what they called the problem of youth. Now, of course, we are talking about the 1960s, and this is something that happened in other countries as well. But the feeling among Israeli parents was that they were losing their children as Zionists. Indeed, as the crisis continued, more and more Israelis felt as if the Zionist dream was over and everything was falling apart. Zionism as an idea is no longer relevant to the Jewish question today, wrote Chaim Guri, the poet. A scholar at the Hebrew University called Yosef Salmon wrote, "Israeli society has lost its national social vision and is thereby entering a new post-Zionist crisis in history of the Jewish people. This is 1966. Post-Zionism is not something of today. This is something which in 1966 you can hear and see in the newspapers. And Yaakov Talmon, who was the dean of the Israeli historians, asserted that Israel had entered a post-rationalist era, by which he also seemed to be saying that the dream was over. This is a very, very common idea in the newspapers. A leading columnist for Maariv called Shmuel Schnitzel feared that Israel was losing its historical uniqueness and becoming just another Hong Kong. Let's take a look at politics. The great founding father, David Ben-Gurion, had been replaced by a life-size politician called Levi Eshkol, a very decent and competent man, but no charisma at all, and very few Israelis trusted him. More and more Israelis felt that the political leadership was inadequate given the problems facing the society. And then in 1965, there were renewed acts of Palestinian terrorism. Just another word about politics. Israelis felt so badly about the government, they did what is probably the worst thing a population can do to its political leaders. They invented jokes about him. There were actually little booklets passed from hand to hand with Eshkol jokes in them. All of them pointed to his indecisiveness. Like you ask Eshkol, would you like tea or coffee? And he says, give me half and half. Then these jokes became worse, again, as an atmosphere of black humor. Eshkol drowns in the river, somebody saves him, and he says, thank you very much, you saved my life, what can I do to thank you? And the other man says, do nothing, just don't tell anybody that I saved him. Now, and on top of that, in 1965, the first acts of Palestinian terrorism start. Now, few people realize that they actually started that early, because the earliest people tend to remember is the dramatic hijackings of planes in the early 1970s and associate Palestinian terrorism with the results of the Six-Day War. No, it's the other way around. It's actually a sense of helplessness to deal with these acts of terrorism, which to a large extent lead to the war. We have records of meetings between Eshkol and the general staff. It's a very natural thing for a prime minister to do. He calls his generals and he asks them, what can we do against these Palestinian terrorists? And the generals don't have an answer. Again, this is something that is reflected in the press and everybody knows about it. We don't really have an answer to Palestinian terrorism. The only thing the army was able to suggest was strike at Syria. Why Syria? Because the terrorists were penetrating Israel through Syria. Some came through Jordan, the others came through Syria. So it is Palestinian terrorism. If you want a new round in the battle for Palestine, which led to increased tension along the Syrian border, and this tension in turn led to the crisis at the Egyptian border. So this comes for the Israelis at probably the lowest point in their psychology, their psychological strength. By the time President Nasser moved large military forces into the Sinai Peninsula, had the UN forces removed and announced that he was closing the waterway to Eilat, Israel was psychologically worn out for the reasons which I have outlined before. Israelis truly believed that Egypt was out to destroy their country and exterminate them. The term exterminate, Lashmid, was used frequently and evoked the Holocaust, of course. Now, the story of the Israelis and the Holocaust is a different one, but the Six-Day War is relevant to there also. We do have in Israel, and we always had, a certain degree of manipulation with the Holocaust. For example, if, as it happened, you go to the foreign ministry in Jerusalem, directed the Israeli embassy in Washington, seek for an immediate appointment with the editor-in-chief of the New York Times and convince him that Nasser is Hitler. And these are your talking points. Okay, so this is using the Holocaust for some kind of national diplomatic goal. But we also know that municipal rabbis in Tel Aviv went out to sanctify parks and football fields because they expected hundreds and thousands of casualties, dead people who would have to be buried. And so there's no question that this was genuine. And I think that only this thing about the municipal rabbis, I think, is particularly striking to me, because I always think that it's only a country that had a society that had experienced the Holocaust can prepare so meticulously to the second one. And here again is where these letters are so important. Private letters people send to friends and relatives abroad. These are not meant for the New York Times. This is not manipulation. These are genuine feelings which people express. The Holocaust is a very central theme. Again, I'm talking about 500 letters, which is a lot of letters. And the Holocaust is always there. How can it be that only 20 years after we are facing the same thing as our parents? How come that we are facing the same thing again we had already faced? How come the world hasn't learned anything? No question about it. The fear is absolutely genuine. And so it is for this reason that I have concluded that the war with Egypt was inevitable. I think that, this calls for some lengthy diplomatic thing, but believe me, I won't go into the details, but believe me that during the days of the crisis, lots of alternatives came up. There were all kinds of ways to end the crisis without a war. And they're all outlined in the book. But all of them required stronger spirit and stronger leadership. By June of 1967, Israel was simply too weak, very weak, too weak not to strike back at Egypt. But the war with Egypt, as you know, was only one of three wars that were fought that week. And I think it's very important to distinguish. When we say the Six-Day War, it's a misleading term. We really have three wars going on. There's a war against Egypt, one against Jordan, and one against Syria. And I think that while the war with Egypt, as I said, was an inevitable outcome of Israel's demoralization and sense of helplessness, the fighting with Jordan and Syria expressed a surge of power and a messianic passion. Indeed, the conquest of the West Bank and East Jerusalem contradicted Israel's national interest. And this is not something I am saying to you in hindsight. This is something that was defined by Israel's top policy planners 6 months prior to the war. This was a rare moment in Israel's history. Actually, policy planners sat down to think. What is it we want? To plan. We never do that in Israel. But between November 66 and January of 67, a series of deliberations examined Israel's relations with Jordan. The participants were representatives of the Mossad, of the Foreign Office, and of the Army's intelligence branch. They ask themselves under what circumstances may it be necessary for Israel to take the West Bank. For example, if King Hussein falls, it was in the interest of Israel to protect King Hussein, but if he falls, we may need to take the West Bank. For example, if the Palestinians rebel against King Hussein. For example, if Iraq invades Jordan. There was a whole set of scenarios which they outlined, which they studied. Everything is recorded. Everything is documented. All the documents are open in Jerusalem at the Foreign Office. They exchanged papers. They argued a little bit. One corrected the paper of the other. Eventually, they came up with a common paper, which they sent to the Prime Minister. And the bottom line is, it is not in the interest of Israel to take the West Bank. We should do everything we can to avoid the necessity to take the West Bank. Why? Because of the Palestinian population. Very easy. Because Hussein was encouraging a common national entity between both sides of the Jordan, the West Bank and the East Bank. He was encouraging Palestinians to leave the West Bank to the East Bank and from the East Bank to other Arab countries. The 15 preceding years, about 200,000 Palestinians had left the West Bank. And so it made sense for Israel to conclude it is not in our interest to take the West Bank. It's so logical, and I think that you might say that this was the Israeli thinking. This was not something everybody knew, but the ones who plan, the ones who think what might happen in the next future, they agreed it is not in the national interest of Israel to take the West Bank. Now, when the occasion presented itself in June of 1967, as a result of a Jordanian attack on West Jerusalem, all reason was forgotten. And now, of course, a Jordanian attack on Jerusalem calls for some response. Fight back. Destroy the army. Humiliate the king. I don't know what you can do. But why occupy the West Bank? You know that it's not in our interest. Why take the West Bank? It requires a different, this is a question that requires a different answer than the war with Egypt, because the existential danger was no longer present. We had already won the war against Egypt. Within 19 minutes, the Egyptian Air Force was gone. Not everybody in Israel knew that, but the government knew that. They already celebrated. No more existential danger. No existential danger led to the occupation of the West Bank. So, yes, there were some strategic considerations, maybe. And, of course, the destruction of the entire Egyptian Air Force also further encouraged the Israeli government to strike at Jordan. But I think the main drive behind the conquest of the West Bank was emotional, was historical, was religious. Also, the failure to take this area, particularly the old city of Jerusalem in 1948, had been an open wound ever since, and 1967 provided a second chance. So the conquest of the West Bank comes from the guts, from the hearts of the ministers, not from their heads. And they chose, as I said, a course of action which, according to their own assessment, to Israel's own assessment, contradicted the country's national interest. The decision to take East Jerusalem is particularly striking. We do have the records today, again, thanks to a lovely widow who herself passed away in the meantime. But we do have records of the ministers sitting and deciding to take East Jerusalem. There are no experts, there are no papers, there are no alternatives, there are no scenarios. Nobody raises the legal question. What will we ever do with the holy places of the Christian world? And most striking is the fact that not one of the participating ministers raises the question, why is it in the interest of Israel to have East Jerusalem? I mean, you are about to make a decision. You can decide to take it, you can decide not to take it. So why is it in your interest? They never ask themselves, because the answer is clear. It is in the interest to have East Jerusalem, to have the holy places, to have the Temple Mount, to have the way to the Wailing Wall. By the way, they could have decided to occupy only the way to the to open the way to the Wailing Wall to Israeli Jewish worshippers and say that it is in accordance with the 1949 armistice agreement which Jordan signed and constantly violated. This would have made sense. But these are people, and many Israelis and many Jews in the world, when they say Jerusalem, they don't mean West Jerusalem. They mean Arab Jerusalem, historical Jerusalem. Now, once taken, Jerusalem could not be given back, again, for emotional reasons. In other words, on that day, the Israeli government actually decided, without necessarily knowing that, but what they actually decided was that there will be no peace. Because without giving back Jerusalem, there will be no peace, and Jerusalem cannot be given back. This, of course, raises the question, could they know that? And the answer is that perhaps not. Perhaps they could not know that. If they thought about it at all, I think they didn't think about it a lot. But in as much as we have some evidence here and there that they did think about it, they thought that they will be forced to give back East Jerusalem to the Jordanians very soon. I was actually a volunteer on a kibbutz. I was not drafted on that particular day because I had no reserve unit yet. And so I was volunteering on a kibbutz, and as soon as we heard that Jerusalem was taken, we abandoned the kibbutz to the enemy, whatever, who cares? We rushed back to Jerusalem and just to be there, you know, because we felt that perhaps within hours, perhaps tomorrow, it won't be able to go there anymore. And I belong to a generation of people who were born in Jerusalem, grew up in Jerusalem, very much under the impact of the division of Jerusalem. We used to climb up tall buildings to peek into Jerusalem and see, wow, there is life on the other side of the moon. And so it is possible that the decision makers who decided, the government who decided to take East Jerusalem, was not aware of the fact how harmful it was historically to do so. This then leads to another question which is often discussed, and that is, did Israel miss an opportunity to make peace immediately after 67? Was there a chance, having taken all these territories, for the first time since the creation of the state, we have something to give the Arabs? Until 1948, we had nothing to give them. All of a sudden, we have something. Can we trade what we have for peace? Again, this is a very long and somewhat tiresome needs a somewhat tiresome discussion, but again, the bottom line of a diplomatic kind of discussion going through all the documents. But again, the bottom line is, I think that Israel did not miss a chance. I think that the Arabs were not ready, the Palestinians were not ready, and Israel was not ready to give back these territories. So one of the reasons why is, again, psychological. Rational point of view, yes, perhaps, but the euphoria which followed the war was as immense as the depression that had preceded the war. Again, just as they told each other the joke about the sign hanging at the exit gate in Tel Aviv Airport, they told each other a joke about two Israeli generals, who one general asked the other, what do you think we should do today? And the other says, I think we should take Cairo. And the other says, well, that's a good idea, but what should we do in the afternoon? So this is the kind of psychology which these people had. They believed that the sky is the limit. And this takes them all the way to 19, 73, you know what happened. This precise belief in the unlimited power of Israel. So I don't think that we could have traded the territories for peace in 1967, but I do think that a major blunder was done then, but it did happen. And that was, I think that Israel was in a situation to ease the problem of the Palestinian refugees in 1967. Again, this is not something I say in hindsight, because the documents are there, and they piled up on the desk of Prime Minister Eshkol more and more plans how to solve the Palestinian refugee problem. Until 1967, Israelis did not really have a very clear idea that Palestinians even existed. When we said Arabs, we meant Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, maybe the most, never Palestinians. We had no idea that there is such a thing as a Palestinian problem. Once a year, it would come up for discussion in the UN, and then people would regard it as a some kind of diplomatic nuisance. But after the war, of course, we were faced, wow, all of a sudden, with a Palestinian problem. And there were many people in the government who said, this is the time to solve the refugee problem. This is our chance. Now, there are governments and there are Jewish philanthropies abroad who actually stand in line and say to the Israeli government, there is no money problem. We give you every money you need. By the way, if you look at the studies which dealt with the possibilities of resettling Palestinian refugees, it's nothing. It's like $40 million for 10 years. This is about what they thought it should cost to relocate like maybe 250,000 Palestinian refugees. The idea, there were many plans and many ideas and many discussions. The idea which they eventually agreed to was that the best thing was to take a number of refugees from Gaza and settle them on the West Bank. And this would not be such a dramatic transfer population. You know, they had been for 19 years in refugee camps in Gaza. They will move a few kilometers to the West Bank and live there. And nothing happened. The plans are there, and nothing happened. And you can imagine that would be we would be much better off. Perhaps we wouldn't have peace with the Palestinians, but imagine if the Palestinian refugee problem, the real social problem in Gaza, would be easier by 250,000 or 250,000 families, which at that time was a lot. So we didn't. We didn't do anything. And this, to me, is the real failure, the real blunder of 1967. The reason why we didn't do anything was political. There was a psychological reason also. Israel at that time and still today has a very hard time to admit that we have any share in the responsibility for the creation of the Palestinian problem. And so we have a very difficult time to contribute anything to the solution of the refugee problem. Prime Minister Eshkol also genuinely thought, seriously thought, that eventually the population from Gaza will be moved to Iraq. He spoke about it with President Johnson. So, and Moshe Dayan, who was our defense minister, said, why do anything? The UN is taking care of that problem. It's not our problem, really. But the major reason was that people in Eshkol's government, Begin, Dayan, Alon, hardliners, said to him, the West Bank should be kept for Jewish settlement. And if you move Palestinian refugees to the West Bank, you have no government. Eshkol was weaker after the war, even more than he had been before. And so this is a time when we really should have a stronger prime minister. He knew that it's the right thing to do, but he didn't dare to do it. And so we are still in 1967, because these are still the problems. Jerusalem, without solution. Palestinian refugee problem, without solution. And so this is why, to me, I tend to think of 1967 as Israel's longest year, the year that still lasts today. I belong to a generation of Israelis who grew up to believe in peace. We were very much encouraged when President Carter worked out a peace agreement between Israel and Egypt. And we thought that it would be the first step. I think the main difference between us today, between us and between today's generation, is that young people in Israel today don't believe in peace anymore. I think that there is a problem with a generation of people who grow up to see war as the routine. And that's the real tragedy. And so it's not only about leaders, it's also about the population, both Israelis and Palestinians. There is today a generation of Israelis who look at us people, both, by the way, from the right and from the left. The leftists are even more interesting because they look at us and say, well, you promised us peace 40 years ago. You did nothing. All this peace movement, peace now, all these nice things, you achieved nothing. But, of course, also the people from the right. And I think that there is 40 years is a very long time. And so these are almost two generations now of people who know no peace. Worse than that, they know, they have experienced at various points hopes. The geopolitical situation has changed. The conflict has become much deeper, more violent, much more difficult to solve. And so there is no wonder that young Israelis don't believe in peace anymore. But then this is a more realistic generation, less idealistic than ours. They don't believe in grand solutions, but I think they believe in conflict management. And I do too. So peace may not be attained in the foreseeable future, but perhaps this is a generation that might manage the conflict in a way that, in a more rational manner, in a way that makes life more livable. While I'm visiting these last months in America, I'm a visiting professor at Berkeley University, and I had a visit from my son, who is 26. He studies electronic engineering in Israel. And I tend to think of him as something of a Zionist miracle. This is an adopted son who was born in Ethiopia. There was a time when, like 20 years ago almost, when 20,000 Ethiopian Jews were sitting in front of the Israeli embassy in Addis Ababa, and I went there, and I did a story on them, and we got to talk to people, and we got to talk to this little boy. And a few days later, I flew back on an immigrant plane full with immigrants, and this tiny little guy comes up to me and says, we know each other. And so I decided that I will make him my story now, and I will follow his life as an Ethiopian little kid becoming an Israeli. And I wrote a diary of him from time to time in my newspaper. When he was 14, he said to me that it's time for him to go back and look for the grave of his father in Ethiopia. So I said to him, how can I possibly get you back to Ethiopia to look for that? But he said, yes, you can, you can. You are a famous journalist. If you only want, you can take me back. And I spoke to my editor, and he said, well, that's a great idea. Why don't you take him back? And so I actually took him back to Ethiopia. It was a very, very emotional kind of trip and very adventurous trip. Actually, we had to walk for 18 hours. Do I look like somebody who walks for 18 hours in the hills of Ethiopia? But we did. And it was a very emotional thing for both of us. I thought a lot about my own father during those days was killed in the war of 1948. And we found the boy's grave, father's grave. And when we came back, we just knew that we are father and son. And that's what we are. So during his spring break, he came to visit me in Berkeley. And we went to Las Vegas. And as we were sitting there in the middle of a casino, we got to talk about life. And I asked him, Itayo, do you believe in peace in the middle of the casino? And he said, you know, I don't. And so I said to him, why then go back to Israel? Maybe you want to live in America. And he looked around. He had just made $102 on the roulette. And he looked around and he said, no, I don't want to live in America because I have already been an immigrant once and I don't want to be an immigrant another time. I already have my own country. Ah, but what about the wars, the future wars? And so he said, we'll think of something. And somehow I believe that they just might do that. Thank you very much.
Israeli journalist and historian Tom Segev speaking on 1967, Israel's Longest Year. Mr. Segev was introduced by Professor Stephen Katz, director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies, sponsor of tonight's lecture. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15, which includes shipping and handling. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of Boston University's World of Ideas and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's show was produced by Tim Scobe with help from Mike Toda and Michelle Tash. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.